right, then. We will proceed with the next case on this morning's Zoom calendar. It's in the marriage of Renee McGeary versus John McGeary, case number A230418. We are conducting the hearing by Zoom technology this morning. The rules are the same. Each side will have 15 minutes for primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please be mindful of the timing mechanism on the screen and any attempts to interrupt you with questions by the judges. With that, we're ready to hear from counsel for appellant.
Thank you, and may it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Jason Brown, and I represent the appellant in this case, John McGeary. Your honors, we're asking the court to reverse several findings made by the district court in this case, given the district court's abuse of discretion. There are three key issues that we have outlined in our brief. The first being the question of whether Mr. McGeary committed marital waste. The second is whether Mr. McGeary is obligated or was obligated to reimburse Ms. McGeary a full $49,029. And the third issue as to whether the McGeary's were obligated to replenish a 529 plan for their children in the amount of $37,823.
Mr. Brown, before you get started with the argument, the first issue you raised, I mean, isn't the real issue whether the district court abused its discretion in dividing the marital property in a way that was that the court that was unequal? I mean, isn't the question not so much why, but whether the unequal distribution was equitable and within the district court's broad discretion?
I think that's a fair way to characterize it, Your Honor. In this case, however, it appears that the reason the court made a disproportionate allocation was really based on two findings, both of which we believe were in error. First, that Mr. McGeary committed waste by engaging in some investing. And second, the court in its findings at finding, let me take a look here, at finding of fact 45, found that Ms. McGeary was entitled to a $45,000 non-marital claim. The district court said that that was done by stipulation by Mr. McGeary. He did not stipulate to that. He stipulated to a mere $7,000 non-marital claim in favor of Ms. McGeary. So there are a couple of mathematical errors that we have briefed. But in addition, Your Honor, to answer your question, it seems the sole basis for the disproportionate allocation was on a claim that Mr. McGeary wasted over $200,000 in a nuclear investment gone bad.
So let me ask you a little bit about that. I mean, there as I understand the record, there's no documentation that says exactly when your client made this investment, the nature of the investment, the circumstances. But I think you would agree with me that the respondent wasn't involved in making that decision to invest in this nuclear investment. Is that accurate?
I would agree with that. Yes, she was not involved.
Okay. And I think your client's testimony was that the funds came from an account that was non-marital, the account she didn't have access to, and that was his non-marital property.
That is correct. And that's one of the linchpins, I think, in this case. The overarching question is, frankly, can someone commit marital waste using a non-marital asset? And I don't think the answer to that is yes. The Quick case requires the identification of a very specific marital asset that was somehow liquidated or deprived by the other side. But all the evidence, all indications, whether it's in the form of testimony or admissions or even the finding of the district court, were that this money that went bad in nuclear was Mr. McGeary's non-marital asset. And so
my concern about all that is that your client had the burden of proof, right, on the question of whether the approximately $200,000 that he chose to invest in whatever this nuclear-related investment was marital or non-marital. What evidence did he submit to meet his burden of showing that that amount of money was in its entirety non-marital? What's the evidence admitted at trial?
Yeah, the evidence is as follows. Ms. McGeary, she testified, first of all, that those funds were non-marital. She testified that the origin of those funds was from premarital home sale proceeds derived by Mr. McGeary prior to their marriage. Mr. McGeary testified that he placed those funds into an investment account in his own name. And again, Ms. McGeary testified she had no access to those funds.
And is this just so I understand the record? I mean, we're talking about the Fair Isaac fund, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And I think that we have the got so many different papers here. I mean, that fund, as I understand it, the rollover contribution was made sometime in 2006. To
That's
that
correct.
fund, to start that fund.
That is correct.
And that was during the marriage.
That was during the marriage, yes. In addition, to answer your prior question, counsel for wife confirmed on the record that the money lost was money that Mr. McGeary, and I'm quoting now, brought into the marriage and lost due to a bad investment. And in addition, the district court noted that wife testified he took what she said was premarital retirement and made a bad investment in nuclear. And so, Your Honor, without having the typical tracing, Mr. McGeary represented himself at trial. And I understand we would probably like the record to have a more clear tracing of that non-marital interest. But the mere admission by Ms. McGeary, as called out by the district court, that this was premarital money, I think in and of itself satisfies his burden of proof that this was non-marital in origin. So the district court cited the Quick case, and the Quick case requires a finding of waste if a party in a dissolution action liquidates and spends a marital asset, which we don't have in this case, and the trial court may then count its full value in dividing the marital property. So we need a marital asset, and then we need spending or liquidation under Quick. Now, the Quick decision involved a very straightforward scenario involving waste. A physician in Quick owned a couple of classic Rolls-Royce and Bentley vehicles, and he took those vehicles during the pendency of the proceeding, or maybe shortly before, and he sold them, and he realized around $90,000 in money from them. He took those funds for himself. Those funds, in the Quick decision, were properly characterized as waste because there was an identifiable marital asset in the Rolls-Royce and Bentley, and there was, in fact, a liquidation. The Rolls-Royce and Bentley were sold, and he took the money. But that's not what happened in this case. What happened in this case is that Mr. McGeary didn't liquidate the account. He didn't spend it. He didn't convert it to cash. Instead, he made an investment decision. Now, that investment went bad. And nobody, including Mr. McGeary, is pleased about that. But when a district court starts to consider investment choices as waste, we run into a very significant slippery slope.
But does it
Every
make a difference? And I think you have some good arguments about whether the district court erred in analyzing the loss of these invest of this investment as a dissipation of assets. But the parties are under obligation to the extent this is a marital that the money he used to invest in the nuclear investment was marital in nature. Just assume it was for purposes of this question. I mean, parties do have an obligation to preserve marital assets, correct? That exist throughout the duration of the marriage and so wouldn't be tied to efforts to deprive someone during the context of a dissolution proceeding, right?
I certainly acknowledge that. There's a fiduciary obligation each party to a marriage has to protect and make wise decisions with their money. There's no doubt about that.
So to the extent, and assuming this just for purposes of this question, that we were to agree with the district court that these investment funds were marital assets, a represented a marital asset, would this duty to preserve the obligation of parties to preserve assets and failure to do so by making a poor decision justify an inequitable distribution as the court did here?
I think that is certainly possible, and I think in some cases probably justified. The question, I suppose, is what was going on in Mr. McGeary's mind at the time he made the investment? Certainly, Mr. McGeary, there's no evidence that Mr. McGeary decided that he wished to lose the $200,000 that he had worked so hard to accumulate. There's no evidence to suggest he did so in contemplation of divorce or with an intent to deprive. And so, again, I go back to this position that to question if the court were to accept the premise that, hey, he made a bad investment, which we know now in hindsight, that would call into question the actions of any and all litigants as part of a divorce as to what investment choices they made during the course of their tenure. There are companies that go bankrupt regularly. There are companies that flourish regularly. Some investments go up, some go down. Some go up because of specific decisions people make. Some go up or down because of the market forces that none of us really have control over. And so I would submit that on the one hand, if the court is to accept the premise that if an investment loss is to be scrutinized and the person who made the decision to that led to the loss has to bear the consequence, I think it would logically flow that the person who makes a good investment choice and yields, let's say, a tenfold return, let's say that that spouse purchased Amazon back in the late 90s and now they've got a $10 million portfolio on an investment of $100,000, to suggest that a poor investment rests with the person who made the decision necessarily means that a good investment decision also gets to rest with the person who made the investment. And those two concepts are directly contrary to the principles of equitable distribution. People's money rises and falls together during the course of a marriage, given their fiduciary and their marital relationship to one another. I do want to quickly hit on a couple other points. My time is quickly coming to an end. There is a question here about gambling and whether or not husband engaged in acts of gambling that would also constitute acts of waste. We have outlined in our brief very thoroughly the issue, but here's the bottom line. The testimony was by Ms. McGeary that Mr. McGeary gambled thousands of dollars over the course of their marriage. Now, we know from the findings of the court that he earned better than $1,750,000 during that marriage. For the court to have found waste on someone who, if you take the average, was around $2.50 a day, constitutes, I think, an abuse of discretion. That's about half the price of a cup of coffee at Starbucks. And there's not a judge out there who's going to say that someone going to Starbucks each morning on the way to work is committing marital waste. And so it's a question of context. The
Well, how about
second.
this? The context was, as I recall, the marital home, which was a major asset that the parties had going into this dissolution. When you took out sales commissions, things like that, was about $200,000, something less than that, 171, something like that. I mean, and doesn't that sort of undermine your argument that the amount of this investment loss was negligible?
Well, again, the gambling loss was negligible. I wouldn't submit that the loss in nuclear, the alleged loss in nuclear, was not an insignificant number. It was. But I'm suggesting to you that the gambling piece that the court dedicated time to in supporting its waste analysis, I think that was misplaced. I think the in the context of the overall financial picture of these parties, thousands of dollars. That doesn't mean tens of thousands of dollars. It means thousands. It means probably less than $10,000. And so, again, over the course of the marriage, we're talking about a very small amount of money, less than a Subway sandwich for lunch each day. And again, I don't think that a court would find that that constitutes waste. Or I don't think that this court would affirm a finding of waste if that were the case. And as important, there was testimony by wife that there was some money yielded from gambling that resulted in investment in cryptocurrency equipment valued at $20,000, so more than just thousands, and that was awarded to husband as part of the ultimate property distribution. The last two pieces I want to hit on with the 1 minute I have remaining is this $49,000 reimbursement to wife. It's a math error. If wife incurred, Ms. McGeary incurred $49,000 in debt and the court ordered them and said it wanted to order them to divide that, then Mr. McGeary's share of that is around $24,000, yet the court made him reimburse her for the full $49,000. And then lastly, this $37,000 payment to the 529 plan, Ms. McGeary unilaterally withdrew money from this 529 plan to pay private school tuition, a legitimate use of those funds. And so if the parties created this account for the benefit of their children, the funds were used for the benefit of their children. Mr. McGeary should not be ordered to have to replenish those funds because, again, they were used for their purpose. So we're asking the court to reverse, and I'll have a few more comments in rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent. Could you identify yourself for the record before beginning?
Thank you and good morning, Your Honor. My name is Katie Lammers. May it please the court and counsel, I represent the respondent in this appeal. Your Honors, this case is about the district court's broad discretion in determining credibility of witnesses and its broad discretion to make an equitable distribution of marital assets. It is well established that in Minnesota, an equitable distribution of marital assets does not necessarily mean mathematically equal. It is a
Ms. Lammers, before you get too far in your argument, I want to just make sure I understand the factual record appropriately. Mr. Brown told us during his initial argument that your client testified, basically agreed that he had taken $192,000 or $200,000 in non-marital assets and invested it with this nuclear investment. Is that what your client's testimony was at trial?
Your Honor, she did acknowledge that he had some assets prior to the marriage, but specifically, and I think Mr. Brown concedes this, there was no finding made that those were non-marital assets. A lot of non-marital claims have to do with commingling. And when there was testimony that as of March of 2007, there was $223,000 in that account that was after the marriage, that was no longer in the account after the spend down. While there was some testimony that both parties came into this marriage with some assets, it's a very important distinction that the appellant bears the burden of proof to establish that that's non-marital. Mr. Brown concedes that he didn't do a tracing. He didn't establish that it was non-marital. And simply by that acknowledgement through testimony, Your Honor, it's simply not enough to rise to that level of a non-marital claim. And thus, with the presumption in marital dissolutions that all of the assets are marital in nature, that is the way that essentially this was treated here. And looking at the way that the district court applied sort of this comprehensive approach, we had an individual, the appellant, who is a high income earner throughout the marriage. He was the breadwinner throughout the marriage. And starting in about 2018, when he became unemployed, he continued to gamble with family funds. He continued to dissipate assets. And when
we're- Let me ask you this, getting back to the issue of the bad investment, which I think the court treated as somewhere in the neighborhood of $200,000. As I review the exhibits, including the Fair Isaac retirement savings statements and ultimately the Blue Stem statements, it appears that this amount of money, the $192,000 that was rolled over from somewhere in 2006 to Fair Isaac, that money never shows up in the Blue Stem account that was opened in 2010, does it, Ms. Lammers?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it does.
So doesn't that fact suggest that the district court erred in treating this as a dissipation or waste? I think waste is sort of an antiquated term at this point, but a dissipation of marital assets situation under 518.58 subdivision 1A.
Your Honor, I don't believe that it does, but even if it fails under 1A, the court still can consider subdivision 1, which is the contribution of each in the acquisition, preservation, and depreciation and the amount of marital property. But I don't believe that actually, even with that finding, that it means that the appellant did not dissipate in anticipation of the divorce. In the Fick case, this court looked at even when the evidence does not establish that a party purposely concealed, dissipated, or misused marital assets, a party could still be credited or charged with that property if they nevertheless exercised dominion over the property and had discretion over the use of the money. So this comes back to the fiduciary duty piece that's very clear. And it's also clear from the record that Ms. McGeary did not have access or say or decision making in terms of where those investments went. And so when we look at the behavior by Mr. McGeary in terms of his approach to the overall preservation of the marital estate, that impacts very significantly. And coupled with the court's broad discretion to be able to determine who is credible at trial, what evidence is credible at trial, and we defer to that district court's discretion, I believe that the district court did not abuse their discretion in unequally dividing the retirement property.
But to me, that's a separate question of did the district court legally err by applying 518.58 subdivision 1A, which I'm having a hard time seeing how that applies given what the limited evidence of the investment shows about when husband may have taken what you describe as marital or characterize as marital assets out of the account.
In
How do
terms
we
of
get around that legal error if
the timing, Your Honor, is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Well, with
Is it a,
respect to
how can we say that the district court correctly applied the dissipation subdivision of the statute when the records as they exist seem to suggest that this money was taken out 10 years before the dissolution proceeding was commenced?
and Your Honor, even if the dissipation argument as it relates to the timing of the dissolution isn't found, because I think the record is frankly a little unclear as to the timing in terms of when all of these investments were made. Looking at the totality of the circumstances, there is proof in the record that as of 2007, there was $223,000 in a retirement account that then no longer existed as of the date of valuation. And so even if there is a situation where we can't trace through what happened from 10 years forward, we do know that in a snapshot in time, post-marriage, but pre-valuation date, there was $223,000 of retirement assets that were no longer as of the valuation date, Your Honor. And even if the court is struggling with the dissipation perspective, then we turn back to subdivision one, which does allow the court to look at the general approach of each party in the preservation, contribution, and depreciation of the entire marital estate. As Your Honor pointed out, by the time these parties came to divorce, their significant asset was the home, and there wasn't a lot of equity left in that. And a huge part of this, frankly, was due to the appellant's behavior and things that he had said, such as, I'm not going to become gainfully employed. I think the record shows that there are certain actions made by the respondent that were not responsible or not in compliance with his fiduciary duty to this overall marital estate. And I think the court took all of that into consideration. Counsel's request that this court essentially read the Quick case to require essentially that there's an identification of a marital asset and then there's a liquidation, I believe, is a misstatement of the case. I don't believe there's such a thing as the Quick factors. As Your Honor pointed out, marital waste is kind of an outdated term, sort of synonymous with dissipation. And so there are a lot of different cases that talk about dissipation. So I just wanted to point out that I don't believe there's some type of factor in terms of a two-step process that this court or that the district court needed to address as it relates to the Quick case. Furthermore, Your Honor, as you're very well aware, even if the record would support a different outcome or a different finding, under the Vangeness case, it doesn't necessarily mean that there was an abuse of discretion.
Let me ask you about the child-related expenses, basically that are discussed in finding 47, the equalizer finding. Did the district court get that math wrong, as appellant's counsel argues to us? And
He
if
did.
not, can you explain it to me?
I can. Yes. No, they did not get it wrong. In essence, what the court ordered to have happen is they ordered that those expenses come out of the home sale proceeds before the remaining proceeds were divided. So, the way that I hear the appellant's argument is essentially because My client at trial had testified that she was open to an equal division of those children's expenses, that there was an expectation that the court would do that. And what the court did was take it out of the home sale proceeds and then divide the remainder between the parties after different types of deductions, such as expenses for husband, the 529 accounts, other things that netted out against that division. And so when it came out pre sort of above the line, that was how the district court chose to do it. I don't see a mathematical error. I also wanted to point out while we're talking about mathematical errors, counsel for the appellant indicated that there was a mathematical error as it related to the non-marital claim made by the respondent. When you look actually at the number of retirement assets, the 91,000 that was used, that factors in the appropriate non-marital claim, which is about $7,200. So even though the finding is incorrect as it relates to that 47,000, that's actually harmless error because the amount of retirement that was divided was the appropriate amount in the actual chart. So I just wanted to touch on that while I was talking about math errors. So, Your Honor, my answer to that question is no. And just because ultimately that's the court's duty to apply 518.58. They don't necessarily have to say one party asked for this, so I'm going to do that, or one party asked for that, so I'm going to do that. Their burden is squarely to apply the statute. And here, that is what the district court did. The lower court's not bound by any measure to have to only order what something, what a party asked of it. So if we take that in conjunction with this 55-page order that gives lots of detailed findings about the circumstances of this of the parties and the court's broad discretion, the court did not abuse its discretion. Looking at the 529 plan issue, you'll note that obviously a lot of the same themes and law are woven throughout all of these issues, but the line of reasoning that it seems to be from the respondent in terms of why they're objecting to this replenishment is that the children didn't save the money themselves, or that there was a contention that the accounts were used for their stated purpose. And here, Your Honor, appellant himself testified that for the previous 18 years, he had paid for the children's school tuition. This point also goes to the previous point about the children's expenses. He testified and conceded at trial that he didn't pay for any children's expenses through since the dissolution began. Wife and the children had worked to a volunteer program to try to reduce certain things related to the expensive tuition for their private school that they both parties agreed for them to attend. And so when the court took a look at this, maybe the appellant takes an issue with the term rated and doesn't like that term. But again, that's not a reason to upset, the court's order as it relates to that. The district court was within their discretion to reimburse those costs incurred for the children during the pendency of the proceeding. Marital debts are treated under the same statute as marital assets that's been extended by this court in case law. And so we make an equitable distribution of marital debts as well. And simply put, that's what the court did here. A district court abuses its discretion by making findings of fact that are unsupported by the evidence, misapplying the law, or delivering a decision that is against logic and the facts on the record. Only when there's a substantial, unjustified inequity in the property division will this court or should this court reverse that decision. And quite simply, that has not been demonstrated here. The appellant has failed to make a showing of an abuse of discretion on any of these issues. And even if the court could perhaps craft a different order or make a different decision, that does not mean that the order put forth by the district court is defective or that there has been an abuse of discretion. So, Your Honor, I am requesting, Your Honors, I am requesting that the district court affirm or that you affirm the district court's order in this regard. I do have some additional time, so if there's any other questions, I'm happy to address those from the panel. Otherwise, I would cede my time.
All right. I don't see any other questions, so we'll go forward with a rebuttal argument from Mr. Brown.
Thank you. Just to reiterate, I think that if the court the district court were to, and in fact did, make an unequal distribution of some significant marital assets, namely the retirement. This is a case where Ms. McGeary was awarded some $471,000 as compared to Mr. McGeary being awarded some $250,000. There would certainly need to be more than a simple assumption that the court has authority to do that. There would need to be specific findings as to why the court did that. And those specific findings are contained in this court's order. The court made a determination, albeit erroneously, that as a result of Mr. McGeary's alleged waste involving what we all seem to recognize as a non-marital asset, in light of that fact, and in light of some other gambling behaviors, the court did a one-third, two-third distribution, meaning that Mr. McGeary was out approximately $100,000. And so I don't think that it's appropriate to simply say that the court has authority to do something when the court also has to support it with legitimate findings. In this case, the court did not do that. The district court, in addition, relied on several cases that I think were misplaced in its order. First, in addressing the concept of waste, the Rundell decision. And unfortunately, I think for family practitioners, this concept of waste and dissipation, the two sort of go hand in hand, but they're also differing concepts. I think that the family bar kind of wished that there were a greater distinction between what is dissipation and what is waste. But I'm taking dissipation to mean what Rundell says, which is spending money or using or misusing an asset in anticipation of divorce. And there is no record in this case, nothing in the record, I should say, that would tend to suggest that Mr. McGeary did or did not do something with regard to those invested funds in anticipation of divorce. And so I think it's clear that the Rundell decision should not have been relied upon by the district court. In addition, the district court relied on the Watson case. That case, the court, district court determined that someone had spent some marital money and they did it for their own benefit. And as a result, there was waste. That's not what we have going on in this case. There is no evidence that Mr. McGeary somehow spent the money that was in this non-marital retirement account. There is evidence that he made some sort of an investment decision in the confines of the account, but he didn't take any money out. In fact, his testimony, which was undisputed, was that he didn't take a single dollar out of that account. And so I believe that the court's reliance on Watson was also misplaced. Your Honors, what we're essentially asking this court to do is reverse and equally allocate the retirement dollars, taking into account the 7,000, not 47,000, the $7,202 stipulated non-marital claim that Mr. McGeary agreed Ms. McGeary has in her retirement. There was a math error on the part of the court there. We're asking the court to have my client only be ordered to reimburse half of the 49,000, and we're asking the court to order that there need not be a replenishment. Again, these dollars were set aside in an approved account for the purpose of paying tuition, whether private school tuition or college tuition. I know the common treatment of these dollars is for college tuition, but this was a legitimate use of those dollars. And there is no evidence that the children contributed to these accounts. These 529 plans were set up by the parties, funded by the parties, and used unilaterally by Ms. McGeary for the benefit of the children. And so we think it's against logic to require a payback of those dollars. That's all I have, if, unless you have any questions.
And I don't see any additional questions. We'd like to thank the attorneys for their briefing and their arguments. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.